nodded. Thompson lowered himself carefully, mindful of the poltergeists of gravity all around them. It occurred to Hobbs that the second gunner had never been in her private cabin before. He had always been friendly, but perhaps a bit too familiar, as if he felt that his aristocratic roots entitled him beyond his rank. And Hobbs was aware of the effect she had on some crew. Her utopian upbringing had casually included a degree of cosmetic surgery that grey parents would never countenance. She was overwhelmingly beautiful to many of them, and to others a woman of cartoonish sexuality, like a whore in some ribald comedy. She had considered counteractive surgery to make herself more average-looking, but that seemed the ultimate affectation. Hobbs was what she was. The man sighed when he reached the safety of the chair.
"I'm sore all over," he said.
"Who isn't?" Hobbs answered. "Just be glad you can't feel the real 10 G's. Then you'd be sore. Dead by now, in fact." Thompson's head rolled back slowly in exhaustion, his eyes closed. "The worst thing is," he said, "I can't quite place where it hurts. It's like when you turn an ankle and wind up limping for a few days. Then the other ankle gets sore from taking up the slack."
"Collateral injuries," she said.
"Right. But I seem to be all collateral injuries, like I can't remember where the original damage was. Very disquieting."
Hobbs looked down at the table. Her collision with it had spattered the water evenly across the black expanse, and now it revealed nothing but the ship's ambient vibration.
"I know what you mean," she said. "I've been trying to get a hold of it myself, to place it in perspective."
Thompson opened his eyes, squinted at her, then he shrugged.
"Ever been in high acceleration this long before, Hobbs?"
She shook her head. Few of the crew had. High G's were usually reserved for battle, a few hours at most.
"Makes you wonder what we did to deserve it," Thompson said.
Something about the man's voice made her look up from the spattered table. His eyes were narrowed. "We lost the Empress," she answered flatly. He nodded deliberately, as if wary of gravity even in this simple motion.
"A debt that wasn't paid," he said softly.
A slow disquiet took form in Hobbs's stomach, joining the nausea that lay there.
"What are you talking about, Thompson?" "Catherine, do you really think the Navy wants to sacrifice the Lynx?" he asked.
His voice was as soft now, just above a whisper.
"Simply to prevent one compound mind from communicating with one Rick's ship?"
"So it would seem, Thompson," she said.
"But we can't keep the mind cut off forever," he said. "It's a whole planet, for the Emperor's sake. The Rick's will find some way to talk to it."
"Maybe. But not while the Lynx is here."
"However long that is," he said.
She looked down at the table, unable to think for a moment. The water looked different now. The surface tension seemed to be reasserting itself. Droplets and puddles were forming again. It didn't make sense, this spontaneous organization. Was entropy giving way to order? The arrow of time in reverse? What was Thompson talking about?
"Tell me what's on your mind, Second Gunner," Hobbs ordered. "It's obvious, Cathery," he said, "why the Lynx is being sent on this mission. We're being sacrificed to cover the debt not paid."
Hobbs closed her eyes. She only had a few seconds to respond. She knew. Cathery Hobbs had been an above-average student at Academy, but not the best. Coming from a utopian world, she didn't have the discipline of her grey peers. She didn't think herself truly brilliant, just savant at certain types of tactical calculations. But even in her greatest moments of self-doubt, Hobbs always prided herself on one thing. She made decisions quickly. Cathery Hobbs made a decision now.
"Thompson, are you the only one thinking about this?"
He shook his head so slightly that it would have been imperceptible in a low-resolution recording.
"Tell me what you're thinking, Thompson." "We've been friends, right, Hobbs?"
She nodded.
"So you give your word that you'll be discreet?"
Hobbs sighed. She'd hoped it wouldn't come to this, but her decision was made. "The way I see it, Thompson," she said, "we're all dead anyway." He smiled ruefully, folding his hands and shifting in his seat toward her.
"Maximum privacy,"
she told the room and leaned forward to listen.
"Militia worker."
As Rana Harter approached the sniffer, she felt like an imposter.
The red wig tight on her head, the coarse militia fatigues against her raw skin, the military ID bracelet. It all felt like a costume, a ruse that might be discovered at any second. In the burnished metal walls of the facility, her own reflection was only distantly familiar. A holo from childhood. It was as if she were impersonating a previous self. The sniffer created a bottleneck as the workers entered the array facility. Rana felt a moment of panic as she joined the crowd. The week she'd spent alone with Herd in the prefab seemed like months now, the lengthened memory of some summer idol. Isolation had a purity about it, a calm order that was hard to leave behind. The jostling crowd offended her new sensibilities. She wished that Herd were here with her, a familiar presence to guide her through the strange facility. The commando had impersonated Rana for the last week, and knew her way within these walls. But the sniffer would no doubt take umbrage at two Rana Harters entering together. There was a slight updraft in the short passageway of the sniffer, slow fans assisting the human thermal plume, carrying skin cells and dust upward. With these particles, the device could not only DNA type the entering workers, but also detect the effluvia of concealed explosives or weapons, and search frayed hairs and skin cells for signs of drug or alcohol abuse. It could even sniff theft. Valuable pieces of equipment in the facility were given ferro patches. Whatever you were up to, the sniffer smelled you out. Rana held her breath as she passed through. Would the device notice the difference between herself and Herd? The thought of being stopped and questioned terrified her. She might be Rana Harter down to the bone, but she felt utterly false. She hoped her epidermis had recovered sufficiently to satisfy the machine's appetite. Herd had worked a healing balm into her skin all night, trying to restore the cells the commando had mined so pitilessly for her own use. The balm seemed to have worked, taking the pink rawness from her skin, but after the last week, any attempt to put the old Rana Harter back together seemed woefully insufficient. She felt half Rick's now. The sniffer, however, let her through without comment. Herd had drawn a map on a piece of flash paper. Rana held the paper carefully. Any friction and it would incinerate itself. She followed the map through narrow, dimly lit hallways. The tight hypercarbon spaces down here felt like the corridors of an overcrowded ship and smelled of damp and humanity. The facility was overstaffed by half, Rana knew. Herd had said that a fresh load of newcomers had arrived 2 days ago, along with news of another approaching Rick's warship. The signs of organizational confusion were everywhere. Equipment stacked in carry cases, crowding the halls. Break rooms filled with impromptu workstations. Newly assigned workers moving through the hallways carrying order chits and looking lost. The repeater array that collected the planet's comm traffic for off-world retransmission was being refitted to assist Legis's orbital defenses. The changeover from communications to intelligence gathering was taking place at breakneck speed. When Rana met other workers in the hall, she found herself moving like Herd. Another imitation in case any of the passers-by had met the commando in her Rana Harter guise. The avian motions, sudden and tightly controlled, each joint an isolated engine, came to Rana with an unexpected ease. In a week of living with the commando, she had internalized the woman's gait, copying her avian power and unpredictability. The impersonation seemed to work, even though there was a decimeter difference in stature between herself and her captor. A few of the other workers nodded with recognition or said her name in greeting. Rana responded to them with Herd's cryptic smile. It would, of course, be easy to escape the Rickswoman now. She could announce herself to the facility's security forces. Pulling off the wig would certainly get their attention. And she was safe from retaliation. Alexander was absent here. The links from the planetary infrastructure to the entanglement facility had been physically cut by Imperial edict. The usual ghosts of second sight, timestamps, news feeds, and locators, were oddly absent. There was nothing Herd or Alexander could do to her. But if she betrayed them, the happiness would go away. Herd had already injected her with the antidote for the dopamine regulators. The nano's influence had diminished already, the joy she had floated upon for the last week slowly winding down. Herd had insisted, and it was true, that with the gauze of happiness gone, she would be more clear-headed for this job. But her undrugged mind threatened to return to its former state of indecision and fear. She could already glimpse that wavering, all-too-human Rana Harter waiting in the wings. The confident hybrid creature she had become could crumble at any moment. She knew she would not betray her new allies. Rana wanted to keep this reborn self. The Rixwoman and her omnipotent god had erased a lifetime of marginal existence, borderline depression, and unfulfilled potential. They had done more for Rana Harter in a week than the Empire had in 27 years. And besides, this was a mission of mercy, she now understood. Alexander must be freed. Following the map, she found the workstation for Rana Harter, second-class militia worker. The interface was unfamiliar from her days in quantum microastronomy. As Hurd had explained, she had been assigned to monitor and repair the hundreds of receivers, repeaters that funneled the world's data into the entanglement facility. Her transfer here, arranged by Alexander, had been justified by Rana's practical knowledge of distributed arrays. She'd been assigned to the Gap's remote, icy wastes all her career, and had often been required to make her own repairs. But she would be doing more than repairs today. Hopefully, no one would interrupt her shift. The chaos of the overcrowded station was such that a self-sufficient operator was largely left to her own devices. Rana sat, called up the workstation's help mode, and began to look things over. By the end of her shift, Rana Harter had found everything that Alexander wanted. The entanglement facility had been designed for exactly the type of traffic the compound mind envisioned. The facility incorporated a huge number of repeaters that gathered information from local planetary communications, phones, credit cells, taxation minders, legal governors, and pumped compressed versions of these data into the entanglement system. Despite its military provenance, the facility's primary purpose was to link the planet's civilian economy with the rest of the Risen Empire. There were even FM radio transmitters to throughput data to the other Legius planets at light speed. 15 was the fleshpot and de facto capital of the system. In peacetime, these transmissions came into the entanglement facility through hard lines and, in emergencies, through the repeaters. Scattered through the acres of the facility were tens of thousands of tiny civilian band receivers, a vast colony of machines that lived on snow and sunlight. The repeater colony extended for hundreds of square kilometers to the edge of the wire, a lethal barrier surrounding the facility. These receivers were like weeds among rare flowers, banal technology compared with the trans-like communications they supported, but self-repairing and hardy enough to withstand Arctic winters. Rana examined the system with growing frustration, the metallic taste of failure in her mouth. She couldn't help Alexander. Nothing could be done from her repair station to reconnect the entanglement facility to the rest of the planet. The repeater software was too distributed, too autonomous to respond to a central command, and the repeaters themselves were switched off, not ordered into sleep mode, but physically turned off by hand. The Imperials were taking Legius's isolation very seriously. Someone would have to go into the array field itself to make the necessary changes. Past the minefields, sniffers, and microfilament barriers of the wire. It had taken hundreds of militia workers to physically turn the repeaters off. She sighed. There was nothing she could do herself. This was a problem for Alexander and Hurd. If Rana could smuggle them the data she had collected, she wouldn't have to return to this awful place. She searched her workstation for some way to bring the data to Hurd and settled on a memory strip borrowed from a repair bot's internal camera. A schematic of the simple repeaters fit easily into the memory strip's capacity, and she added a map of the array and the barrier wire's specs. Rana shut her station down and erased her researchers. Her shift was almost over. Now she could return to the warmth and safety of the prefab, to happiness. When the shift siren blew, Rana rose from her chair stiffly, hands shaking. The muscles of her legs felt weak. Anxiety had built over the long shift, stealing into every tissue of her body. Rana knew that she needed the surety of Hurd's drugs. Soon. She wished now that she'd eaten something today, but she'd wanted desperately to finish her work in a single shift and never return here. Calming herself by imagining the strip heater glow that lit the prefab, Rana joined the other militia workers jostling their way toward the facility exit. The 6 work shifts of the long Legius day overlapped to prevent this sort of rush hour crowding, but the narrow corridors of the overstaffed station were always crowded, even in peacetime. Rana found herself swept along in a human flow, and the scent of tired workers became overwhelming. Strange how humanity repulsed her now. The empty chatter, the profusion of colors and body types, the clumsiness of the crowd's movement around her. Without trying, Rana still walked with the avian grace of her captor. The imitation had somehow insinuated itself into her bones. She longed to shuck the wig and its pointless decorative excess of hair. Rana closed her eyes and saw the clean lines of Alexander's airscreen charts, the scimitar curves of Herd's weapons, the flavor of Rick's. Biting her lips, she made her way through the halls. Soon, she would be back home. The crowd's progress slowed to a crawl as she reached the exit. Bodies pressed in closer. The overwhelming human smell made Rana's hands begin to shake. The scent seemed to leech all oxygen from the air. Meaningless conversations surrounded and battered her, a hail of empty words. She distracted herself by reading the sniffer's warning signs. Declare any volatiles, nanos, or facility property. With a start, Rana remembered that the sniffer could detect stolen equipment. She shook her head to drive away paranoia. The memory strip in her pocket was insignificant, the sort of cheap media that came free with disposable phones and cameras. Surely it wasn't marked with pharaohs. But among the signs, her nervously darting eyes now found the words, "Sign out all data storage devices." Rana swallowed, remembering the data she'd put on the strip. A map of the facility, the repeater schematics, the specs for the lethal wire. From those three files, her intent couldn't be more obvious. The sniffer was only a few meters ahead of her now. She planted her feet to resist the bodies pressing her forward. Rana fingered the memory strip in her pocket. It was too small to hold a pharaoh patch. But what if they'd sprayed it with pharaohs as a matter of course? Security was tight here, but that tight? Frantic thoughts crowded her mind. The overstaffed facility seemed utterly disorganized. Such a subtle measure didn't seem likely. But she remembered an old rumor about a creeper security nano that Imperials unleashed on top-secret bases. Something that propagated slowly, pharaoh-marking each machine and human it came into contact with, so that everything could be tracked from a central station. The idea had seemed fantastic at the time, the paranoia of low-level workers. But now it seemed just barely possible. The crowd was pressing her impatiently from behind. One of the guards at the sniffer, a marine in Imperial black, was looking at Rana with vague interest as the other workers flowed around her. She ordered herself to move forward. There was no escaping the sniffer without calling attention to herself. But her feet would not move. She was too afraid, too tired. It was too much to ask. She remembered boarding the maglev on the way here, her hesitation before climbing the stairs. That old paralysis, the old Rana Harter, had returned with a vengeance. The marine rose from his stool, eyeing her suspiciously. "Move!" Rana commanded herself, but she remained put. Then a glint of metal caught her eye. Down the sniffer hallway before her, Rana saw the flash of an officer's badge. It was Herd, wearing her militia colonel's uniform, beckoning her forward. At that sight, the panic that had held Rana fast was suddenly broken. She moved toward the sniffer, knowing Herd would protect her, would return her to happiness. Rana Harter stepped into the sniffer, and was for a moment alone, separated from the press of bodies. The updraft took away the rancid smell of the crowd. Then a siren began to scream, so loud that in Rana's synesthesia it became a towering cage of fire around her, as blinding as the sun on lidless eyes. Executive officer. The conspirators met in one of the zero-G courts that surrounded sickbay. The courts were empty, of course, being unusable under high acceleration. The mere motion of playing rackets or dribble hoop in this unstable gravity made Hobbs's knee ligaments ache. There were only five conspirators present, including herself. Hobbs had expected more, actually. Five didn't seem enough of a critical mass to warrant plotting a mutiny. There must be more, but Thompson wasn't tipping his hand yet. No doubt some of his cards were in reserve. She knew all those present. The ringleader, second Gunner Thompson. Yen Hu, another young officer from gunnery. Third pilot Magus, her face sour and strained. And one of the communications ensigns, Darren King. Apparently, this was no crewman's mutiny. Everyone here had stars on their uniform. They all seemed relieved when she walked in. Perhaps, as the ship's second-in-command, Hobbs somehow validated the Enterprise. But Thompson took charge for the moment. He closed the door of the racket's court, which sealed itself seamlessly, and leaned against the small window in its center to block his small hand light from spilling into the hall. The precautions were hardly necessary, Hobbs thought. Under the current cruel regime of high acceleration, the crew moved about the ship as little as possible. She doubted security was monitoring the ship's listening devices very carefully, though Ensign King or other conspirators unknown to Hobbs must be jiggering any bugs in the zero-G court in case they were queried later. This was to be a silent coup. Not really a mutiny at all, Thompson was saying.
What would you call it, then? Hobbs asked. Second pilot Magis spoke up.
I guess, properly speaking, it's a murder.
There was an intake of breath from Yen Hu. The assembled conspirators looked at him. Hobbs was sorry to see Hu in on this. He was only 2 years out of academy. Gunner Thompson must have worked hard to break him down.
A mercy killing, corrected Thompson.
Mercy on...
Magis asked.
Us, Thompson finished. The captain's dead, whatever happens. No point in the rest of us going down with him.
Thompson took a step back from the rest of the group, making them his audience.
The rest of the Empire may believe that pardon, but we know that Captain Zai refused the Blade of Error. The Emperor knows it too.
Hobbs found herself nodding.
This attack on the Rix battlecruiser is a pointless sacrifice of the Lynx, Thompson continued. We should be standing off and coordinating with the Legis planetary defenses, protecting civilians against bombardment. We could save millions. Instead, we're engaged in a suicide mission.
Do you really think the Navy would change our orders at this point? She asked.
If the captain accepts the blade in the next day or so, they'll have time to order us back. The politicals will make up something about Zai the Hero being the only officer who could have pulled off the attack against the battlecruiser. The Lynx can gracefully withdraw back into the system defenses. With Zai dead, it'd be pointless to sacrifice us.
Despite what they were plotting, it rankled Hobbs to hear the captain's name used without the honorific of rank.
My math shows that we've got 25 hours to make turnaround, Second Pilot Magis said. A few more, really. We could always get to 12 Gs after turnaround. No thanks, Thompson said.
With every G they added, the easy gravity field would grow geometrically more unstable.
Well, in any case, Magis said, any longer than 30 hours and we'll be committed to meeting the Rix battlecruiser outside of Legis's defenses.
Hobbs wondered if Magis had taken the precaution of doing the calculations by hand. Computer use, even at trivial demand levels, was always recorded.
And once it's done, we've got to get word back to home that the captain's committed suicide, said Ensign King. Then they've got to make a decision and get word back to us. Assuming we draw from our home-connected entanglement store, there's no comm lag.
But how long will it take for the Navy to make a decision? Magis asked.
The four of them looked at Hobbs. They knew she'd worked as an Admiral Staff Officer before being assigned to the Lynx. Hobbs frowned. She'd seen complex, crucial decisions taken in minutes. She'd seen days go by before consensus was reached. And the decision to save or lose the Lynx was as much political as military. The question was, did anyone expect Zai to take the blade now? Would there be a contingency plan ready to go? But that was irrelevant to Hobbs. The important thing was to keep the conspirators from taking any precipitous actions. If they felt they were up against the clock, they would be harder to control.
It won't matter how long it takes, she said flatly.
Why not? Magis asked.
Hobbs paced a moment, thinking furiously. Then it came to her.
With Captain Zai dead, the Lynx is my ship. The moment I take command, I'll make the turnaround and ask for new orders, she said. Perfect, Thompson whispered.
But you'll be disobeying direct orders, Yen Hu said, won't you?
If they tell us to continue the attack, there'll be time to get into some kind of position, but I don't think they will. They'll thank me for taking the decision out of their hands.
Thompson laughed.
Hobbs, you old devil. I was half certain you'd throw me to the captain for even talking to you, and now you're going to take all the credit for this, aren't you?
He put one hand on her shoulder, the touch intimate in the darkness.
A subtle sort of credit, she said. Let's just say we don't have to cover our tracks too carefully.
What are you talking about? Hu asked. He was completely confused now. Magis turned to the young ensign.
Exo Hobbs doesn't care if the apparatus suspects that mutiny occurred as long as they can't prove it. She believes her initiative will be appreciated.
Hu looked at her with a kind of horror. He had entered into this to save the Lynx, not advance anyone's career. He was obviously aghast that she was thinking past the current crisis of survival. Good, she thought. Hu needed to be focused on the long term. Even if this conspiracy fell apart here and now, he'd already changed his life forever.
So, sometime in the next 25 hours, Thompson said, Lawrence Zai will take the Blade of Error.
The later the better, Hobbs said. My decision to pull the links back makes more sense if there isn't time left to get new orders from the Navy. The captain should go off his watch the day after tomorrow at 9:50, 22 hours from now.
Are we all agreed, then?
Thompson asked. They were silent for a moment. Hobbs hoped that someone would say something. There must be some quiet, cutting remark, she thought, that would bring them all to their senses. At this point, she could still imagine the conspiracy sputtering out. The right words could break the spell that Thompson had cast, only it couldn't be her to speak up. Hobbs couldn't let them suspect her real purpose in joining their conspiracy.
There's only one thing,
Hu said. They waited. The young ensign cleared his throat.
This makes Captain Zai look like a coward, as if he'd been pardoned but killed himself anyway because he couldn't face the Ricks.
Hobbs saw the truth of this dawn on the conspirators' faces, and wondered if Hu had found the right words. For a few moments, no one said anything. They were all from grey families. Posthumous honor was not a thing to be trifled with. In a world ruled by the living dead, the ghosts of the past were taken very seriously. Of course, it was Thompson who finally spoke.
He is a coward, he said bitterly. He couldn't face the blade, that's why we're in this mess.
Magus nodded, then King, and finally Hu, and they placed their hands palm up in the center of their little circle, an old academy team ritual enjoined to this perverted purpose. But Hobbs joined them. Thompson placed his last palm down. The plan was locked. Commando. Hurd stood still for a moment as the siren began to wail, watching the crowd's reaction at a calm remove. She noted that the siren cycled with a 2-second period between 15 and 25,000 hertz. At both its extremes, this sine wave went beyond the range of normal human hearing. It dug down low enough to shudder in the gut like a pneumatic hammer and high enough to shatter fine glass. The siren was evidently designed to paralyze anyone whose hearing was unprotected. Most of the crowd on Hurd's side of the sniffer covered their ears, their knees bending as if suddenly under high gravity, a few dropped straight to the ground. Poor, brain-bugged Rana Harter, for whom sounds were solid and visible, crumpled like a column of sand. Only the two militia guards and the Imperial Marine remained effective. Hurd waited for their slow reactions to unfold. End of side 6. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over. Side 7, The Risen Empire by Scott Westerfeld. Continuing on page 262. As one, they turned their backs on the Ricks commando to face Rana Harter, who lay in the sniffer corridor. They pulled weapons, activated helmet displays, took up firing poses. Satisfied with their incompetence, Hurd sprang into action. In a few steps, she was behind the Imperial Marine, the only real threat to a Ricks commando. Her monofilament knife found the seam between helmet and breastplate. The knife was so sharp, 16 molecules diameter, and her cut so fast that she decapitated him without a drop of blood touching her. She could feel a gurgling sound vibrate the breastplate, but the Marine's death rattle was drowned out by the still protesting siren. The two militia soldiers were side by side, stepping toward the ragdoll Rana Harter with exaggerated caution. Hurd leapt toward the space between them. She saw one stop, cocking his head to listen to a voice inside his helmet. Someone in tactical control had seen her on camera, was trying to warn them. It was far too late for that. She stepped between the militia soldiers and laid a firm hand on their variguns, pulling the barrels away from Rana Harter and toward each other. One obliged her by firing, knocking his partner back 3 meters. Hurd punched him in the face. He had forgotten to lower his visor, and pulled the weapon from his grasp. She turned it on him. The very gun was set to a concussion stun, a wide-area effect meant for crowd control. At a range of 10 centimeters, it burst the man's eyeballs and pushed his jawbone back far enough that it severed his jugular. Hurd reached the sniffer before his body, limbs still flailing with old, irrelevant intentions, hit the ground. Rana Harter was light as a bird. She draped over Hurd's shoulder like something without bones. The siren was focused here in the sniffer corridor, almost loud enough to damage even Rick's hearing. Some sort of gas was drifting upward in the sniffer's draft, but Hurd hadn't breathed since the siren began sounding, and had another 30 seconds or so before she would need to. Her burden secured, the commando began to run at speed in a zigzag course away from the facility entrance, dropping the few standing workers in her path with the appropriated Varigun's concussion effect. She was 100 yards away when the siren cut off, leaving a staggering silence.